Seminal episode number 3, Moaning Lisa. In the first season, we were excited when our hero Jim Brooks wanted to pitch us an episode. His idea? Lisa is sad. That's it. Jim would work out the details with us. Lisa is depressed and Marge can't help her. Then Lisa finds a jazz mentor in Bleeding Gums Murphy, who teaches her it's okay to be sad. And that cheers her up. It didn't sound like a lot of fun, and certainly didn't seem like a great use of animation. No one had much faith in the idea at the time. Matt Groening said to us with a smirk, "Oh, you got stuck writing that one." Sam Simon told us, "Jim's been trying to do that story since Taxi. Nobody would let him." Jim's instinct was right, however, because this was the episode that cemented Lisa as a character. Up until then, she'd just been kind of a girl Bart. The first line we ever wrote for her was something she'd never say now. "Let's go throw rocks at the swans." Moaning Lisa is the episode that first showed viewers the deep emotional reserves in The Simpsons, that a cartoon had the ability to move you and even bum you out. Most of all, it showed that we weren't just a show for boys. Since then, jazz has become a major element in our show. Not that any of us really like jazz. I've always proudly thought there's never been a sitcom episode quite like Moaning Lisa. Then I watched a rerun of Jim Brooks' old series, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, the plot of which was Murray is sad. The episode even ends with Mary giving the same inspiring speech that Marge gives Lisa. But as Judd Apatow points out, quote, "To me, a great Simpsons episode should feel like a great Mary Tyler Moore. There are some silly episodes too, but I love the ones about people finding ways to connect with something larger. And The Simpsons has done this so many times in so many ways." 6 years later, Al and I pitched the sequel episode where Bleeding Gums Murphy dies. Ron Taylor, the lovable voice of Murphy, he looked exactly like the character, by the way. Ron Taylor is at the cast reading of the script, and when we got to the point where he passes away, Ron shouted, "I'm dead?" He'd flown in from Colorado for the reading without ever looking at the script. Al Jean on Moaning Lisa. People always tried to put labels on Mike and me. As a team, we were known as the joke guys on The Tonight Show or goofy shows like Alf. But when we got to The Simpsons, we wanted to do more emotional stories, like stories about Lisa, because we wanted to show we could do those kind of things too. Seminal episode number 4, Treehouse of Horror, the first one. The Simpsons' first season was a cultural phenomenon. Now, 2 episodes into the second season, we were doing a Halloween show, a trilogy of terror. It was a tremendously risky move. Just minutes into the show, we see a zombified Lisa carrying a knife about to murder her whole family. Maggie's head rotates like a lawn sprinkler. It was so frightening that we opened the show with the disclaimer. Marge comes out from behind a stage curtain, aping an actual film preamble to the original Frankenstein, and warns the audience, "Tonight's show, which I totally wash my hands of, is really scary. So if you have sensitive children, maybe you should tuck them in early tonight instead of writing us angry letters tomorrow." The warning proved unnecessary. Our fans loved the show. We did too. How often do frustrated writers get to kill off their characters? A tradition was born. The shows got bloodier and creepier every year, and no one complained. No one even cared when we showed it. If it aired any time between September 12th and November 15th, it was a Halloween show. The show gets harder to write each year. By this point, we've had to come up with 87 different horror archetypes. We quickly spoofed every horror film classic and all the great Twilight Zones. Now we're parodying thrillers like Dead Calm, great art house dramas like The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, lousy art house dramas like Eyes Wide Shut, even Dr. Seuss. Lately, and this is really scary, we've had to come up with original stories. Make it stop! It's even tougher on the animators. Almost every segment has to be designed from scratch, drawing new characters, costumes, and sets. It's the first show we produce each season, which means we start the year by blowing out the budget and burning out the animators. Even coming up with our Halloween names for the credits has become a chore. I've been Murderous Mike Reese, Macabre Mike Reese, Dr. Michael and Mr. Reese, Ms. Iris Eek, that's an anagram, The Thing from Bristol, Connecticut, and the abominable Dr. Reese. Hey, Dad, I finally became a doctor. We also learned one thing not to do from that first Halloween show. Don't get pretentious. The third segment of that Treehouse of Horror was a retelling of The Raven, starring Bart and Homer. It was literate, gorgeously animated, and boring. Edgar Allan Poe is a literary genius. He's my favorite author, in fact. But nobody ever called him funny. When we saw the finished animation, we realized we had to gag it up. We pieced together odd bits of animation to make new cutaway scenes where Bart makes fun of the poem. It helped, but it's still pretty stiff. To this day, professors tell me how much they love that segment. Scholars cite it in academic papers. English teachers show it to their classes. God, I'm so ashamed. Special mention! Homer and Lisa exchange crosswords. The Simpsons writers love puzzles. As early as our first season, we had Bart anagramming a restaurant sign, changing cod platter to cold pet rat. 2 decades later, we built an entire episode around puzzles in our Da Vinci Code parody entitled Gone Maggie Gone. Maggie is kidnapped by nuns, and Lisa must solve a series of riddles to find her. My contribution? Lisa must find the biggest ring in Springfield. It's the letters R-I-N-G in the town's giant Springfield sign. Crossword puzzles are our writer's real addiction. Well, that and Percocet. Many of us start our day with the New York Times crossword. Our newest addition to the staff, Megan Amram, actually constructed a puzzle for the Times. We have one writer who does nothing but solve crosswords all day long. Apparently, this is what we pay him for. I used to do crosswords to get my mind off work, but nowadays you can't do a puzzle without encountering answers like Lisa, Mo, or Apu. I recently did one where the clue was San Francisco Mass Transit. The answer was Bart. Thank God, I thought. The puzzle constructor could have used the Simpsons clue, but didn't. Then I got to the final entry. Quote, what you might say if you can't solve this last clue. The answer was dough. Dough, indeed. Worlds collided in the great episode Homer and Lisa Exchange Crosswords. Lisa finds she has an aptitude for crossword puzzles. She enters Springfield's crossword tournament, where Homer unforgivably bets against her. To atone, Homer persuades crossword constructor Merle Regal and editor Will Shortz, playing themselves, to create a special puzzle for the New York Times. Buried in the clues and solution are Homer's heartfelt apologies to Lisa. What makes the episode amazing is that the final puzzle Lisa solved in our Sunday night episode was the same crossword that appeared in that morning's New York Times. Merle Regal, a brilliant and funny man, had slipped an elaborate Simpsons message past millions of Times readers. It's worth mentioning that the episode's author, Tim Long, is the rare Simpsons writer who doesn't give a crap about crossword puzzles. This happens a lot on our show. The Simpsons visit Israel in the episode The Greatest Story Ever Doed. The Israeli people loved it, and the show was nominated for a Humanitas Award for its promotion of human dignity. The episode was written by the rare non-Jew on our staff, Kevin Curran, a product of Catholic schools who never set foot in Israel. If you like puzzles half as much as we do, you might like these challenges I've created for Will Shortz on NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. Shortz always refers to me on the air as former Simpsons writer Mike Reese. Former? What has he heard that I haven't? None of these puzzles involve The Simpsons. They're mostly about pop culture, and there's a few sneaky twists thrown in. Feel free to cheat. Bart would. Here are the puzzles. Number one, think of a two-word phrase you might see on a clothing label. Add two letters to the end of the first word and one letter to the end of the second word. The result is the name of a famous writer. Who is it? Number two, name a well-known TV actress of the past. Put an R between her first and last names. Then read the result backward. The result will be in order Dr. Frankenstein might give to Igor. Who is the actress and what is the order? Number three, a famous actress and a famous director share the same last name, although they are unrelated. The first name of one of these is a classic musical. The first name of the other is an anagram of a classic musical. Who are they? Number four, take the first name of a famous actress. Drop a letter, rearrange what's left, and you'll get a word used in a particular sport. This actress's last name, without any changes, is where the sport is played. What actress is it? Number five, take the name of a well-known actress. Her first name starts with the three-letter abbreviation for a month. Replace this with the three-letter abbreviation of a different month, and you'll get the name of a famous poet. Who are these two people? Number six, name a famous Greek person from history. Rearrange the letters of the name to get the title of a famous Italian person from history. Who are these two people? Number seven, name a famous actress whose last name ends in a doubled letter. Drop that doubled letter, then insert an R somewhere in her first name. The result will be a common two-word phrase. What is it? Number eight, take two words that go together to make a familiar phrase in the form blank and blank. Both words are plurals, such as bells and whistles. Move the first letter of the second word to the start of the first word. You'll get two new words that name forms of transportation. What are they? Number nine, take the two-word title of a TV series. The first word contains a famous actor's first name in consecutive letters. The second word is a homophone for this actor's last name. Name the series and the actor. Number 10. Take the phrase, no sweat. Using only these seven letters and repeating them as often as necessary, can you make a familiar four-word phrase? It's 15 letters long. What is it? Number 11. Name an occupation in nine letters. It's an entertainer of sorts, an unusual and uncommon but well-known sort of entertainer. Drop the third letter of the name and read the result backward. You'll get two four-letter words that are exact opposites. What are they? Number 12. Think of a 10-letter occupation ending in ER. The first four letters can be rearranged to spell something that the person would study, and the next four letters can be rearranged to spell something else that person would study. What is the occupation? Number 13. What six-letter word beginning with the letter S would be the same if it started with TH? Answers to NPR puzzles. Number 1, Virgin Wool, Virginia Woolf. Number 2, Ava Gabor, rob a grave. Number 3, Emma and Oliver Stone, Mame and Oliver. Number 4, Kirstie Alley, strike an alley. Number 5, Julianne Moore, Marianne Moore. Number 6, Euclid, Il Duce. Number 7, Kate Blanchett, carte blanche. Number 8, Arts and Crafts, Carts and Rafts. Number 9, American Idol, Eric Idle. Number 10, Waste Not, Want Not. Number 11, Daredevil, Live Dead. Number 12, Astronomer, Star Moon. Number 13, Sesame, The Same. How did you do? If you got 12 to 13 correct, you're Professor Frink. 10 to 11 correct, Lisa Simpson. If you got 8 or 9 correct, you're Comic Book Guy. 6 or 7 correct, you're Bart. 4 to 5 correct, you're Homer. 2 to 3 correct, you're Chief Wiggum. If you only got 1 correct answer, you're the Springfield Tire Fire. And if you got 0 correct, you're Ralph. Homer's Massive Boners. I have only a few regrets about my career, and one of them is titling this section with a boner joke. We have a pretty good sense of what our audience can handle. If you're easily offended, you probably stopped watching back in 1990. There are only 4 things we've done in the show's history that I wish we could do over. Number 1, Bart's Tourette's. We wrote a scene where, to get out of taking a test, Bart pretended to have Tourette's syndrome. The censors had no problem with this, but thousands of viewers did. It's the most complaints we ever got about one joke. When the show reran, we changed Bart's ailment from Tourette's syndrome to rabies, the one time we've ever altered a line after public outcry. Rabies is still pretty bad, but if you pet a foaming dog, it's your fault. Number 2, New Orleans. We did a musical parody of A Streetcar Named Desire that opened with a song making fun of New Orleans. Some of the writers were skittish, but I said, "People in New Orleans have a great sense of humor. They're going to love it." Well, they don't, and they didn't. The song begins, "New Orleans, home of pirates, drunks, and whores." That didn't bother them. That's on their license plates. But the next line of the couplet was, "New Orleans, tacky, overpriced souvenir stores." That's what pissed them off. The local Fox affiliate, owned by Quincy Jones, yanked the show off the air for 2 weeks. To make matters worse, Bart was supposed to be king of carnival at Mardi Gras later that year. A New Orleans reporter called to tell me, "You know, when your friend Bart comes down here, we're gonna kill him." I said, "Well, you know, it's not really going to be Bart. It's going to be a tiny man in a foam rubber suit." And the reporter replied, "Well, then we're going to kill him." And they probably did. Number 3, Adopting Lisa. We were doing an episode where Homer's having a triple bypass, and we'd written ourselves into a corner. How does a father say goodbye to his kids knowing he might die during surgery? "Oh, that's easy," said Jim Brooks, and he pitched the scene off the top of his head. Lisa whispers to Homer all the things he needs to tell Bart. Then Bart does the same for Lisa. It was clever, funny, and exceptionally moving. Except for one line. Jim Brooks had Bart telling Lisa, "I guess this is the time to tell you, you're adopted and I never liked you." Many parents of adopted children complain that this is their kid's worst nightmare. A decade later, my friend was developing a sitcom about a girl who feels she doesn't fit in with her family. She said, "We're calling the show Maybe I'm Adopted." I said, "No, you're not. You're never going to get away with it." "Oh, I will," my friend said. "The network loves the title." When the show eventually came on, it was called Maybe It's Me. Number 4, Killing Maude. I left The Simpsons for 2 years to pursue my own projects. When I returned in 2000, we were working on a Ned Flanders scene, and I pitched the line for his wife, Maude. Everyone looked around guiltily, and writer Ian Maxtone Graham finally admitted, "We killed her." Why? Because the actress who played her asked for a raise. Maude died in the 1999 episode, Alone Again, Natura Diddly. She was shot in the face with a t-shirt cannon and knocked over the back wall of an auto speedway. Some critics liked the episode, but it also received the full spectrum of knocks, from harsh and cynical to sappy and lame. One critic even said killing Maude was a sin. I have to agree with that. We killed the nice wife of a nice guy, leaving his 2 nice but annoying kids motherless. When we make a big change like this, like Apu having octuplets or Patty and Selma adopting a baby. We always think we'll get some great episodes out of it. We rarely do. A few years later, we were doing a show where Krusty gets bar mitzvahed. The episode was supposed to begin with Krusty's father, Rabbi Krustovsky, dying. Finally, someone asked, "Why are we killing off all our great characters? The bloodshed must stop." Krusty's father was spared. We killed him 10 years later. Best episodes ever, in my humble opinion. Which is better than your humble opinion? Marge versus the Monorail, Season 4. Conan O'Brien came in with the story on his first day at The Simpsons. Script by Conan, directed by Oscar winner Rich Zootopia Moore. No wonder it's a classic. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Guest Star, Season 16. Homer becomes a Catholic. Why did it take us 16 years to hit on this great idea? And here's a line you don't hear often. Liam Neeson was hilarious. Radio Bart, Season 3. Matt Groening pitched this great story where Bart falls down a well. Terrific direction, sting duets with Krusty. We lost our first Emmy Award with this. The Seemingly Never-Ending Story, Season 17. A story within a story within a story within a story. You don't get that on SpongeBob. Treehouse of Horror number 6, Season 7. For years, one segment of every Halloween show kinda sucked. We usually stuck it in the middle. Treehouse 6 was the first one to have three great segments, plus 3D Homer, and Paul Anka as a guest star. Simpsons Califragilistic Expialidocious, Season 8. Al Jean always wanted to do a Mary Poppins parody. I fought him on this for 5 years. Thank God I lost. It's the most popular thing we ever wrote together. King Size Homer, Season 7. Fat Homer is funny. Really fat Homer is really funny. I mean, look at Peter Griffin. Lisa the Skeptic, Season 9. There are only two seasons of Simpsons episodes I didn't work on, and I'm afraid the show is smarter and funnier without me. This one is my favorite. Last Exit to Springfield, Season 4. I told Jay Kogan, who co-wrote this with Wally Walidarsky, that USA Today had named it the best Simpsons episode ever. He laughed. It wasn't even the best one we wrote that month. Worst episodes ever! Breitbart Dumb Bart, Season 27. To impress Milhouse, Bart says that Homer sells nuclear secrets. Calling Milhouse a high-level source, this fake news makes it to Breitbart, and ultimately the White House. Homer is sent to Guantanamo, where he goes on a hunger strike. It lasts 15 minutes. Soul Train, Season 12. The Simpsons are going to South Korea. They visit an animation house, never realizing it's the one where they themselves are animated. Bart befriends the other 10-year-olds who work in the studio and convinces them to quit. Also, Maggie crosses into North Korea and launches a missile. The Simpsons SpongeBob Crossover Spectacular, Season 8. After Mr. Burns dumps toxic waste into Springfield Harbor, the whole cast of SpongeBob SquarePants is forced to move in with the Simpsons. Marge immediately warms to Bob as the best kitchen sponge I ever used. King of the Hillary, Season 28. Severely misjudging the political climate, the Simpsons writers produced this Inauguration Day special where Trump lost the election. The show features Lisa and Bill Clinton playing the sax at Hillary's inaugural ball, while an embittered Trump becomes Grandpa's new roommate at Springfield Retirement Castle. World Cup Sucker, Season 15. Homer reads an obviously fake list of Krusty's worst episodes ever and falls for it. What a moron! Burning question. What do you think of Family Guy? I get this question every time I make a public appearance. No one ever asks my opinion on Archer. It's overrated. South Park. It's the same show every week. Or BoJack Horseman. I never saw it. When Family Guy debuted 10 years into The Simpsons run, our younger writers were incensed. It's just vulgar. It moves too fast. It's nothing but pop culture references. I had to laugh because these were all things people said about The Simpsons when it began. Maybe that's why I have a soft spot for Family Guy. I think of it as The Simpsons after a few beers, as opposed to Adventure Time, which is like The Simpsons after a series of small strokes. Our staff would endlessly complain about Family Guy, managing to hold two completely contradictory opinions. It's exactly like our show, and they do things we'd never do. The latter is where the show's charm lies. I'm a jaded old TV writer, but that show somehow manages to shock me on a weekly basis. They do jokes about AIDS, abortion, and the Holocaust, topics we've never touched. Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane is like our Ned Flanders. No matter how much we berate him, he's always warm and gracious, and the first to admit his debt to our show. Clearly, this is a man who looked at Homer Simpson and said he needs to be bigger and dumber. We're all family. We boost each other's ratings and make Fox Sunday Night a viewer destination. Even the writing staffs have begun to blend. Simpsons showrunner Mike Scully's brother now writes for Family Guy. Simpsons alum Rich Appel runs the show. All this crossbreeding made the unthinkable a reality, a Simpsons-Family Guy crossover show. When Matt Groening and Jim Brooks agreed to this, I imagined they'd oversee every aspect of the episode. Instead, amazingly, they told Family Guy, "Good luck with the crossover, we'll watch it when it airs." In the end, everyone from both camps loved it, except maybe Seth MacFarlane. The running theme of the episode was that Family Guy stole everything from The Simpsons. They made this point over and over and over and over. Apparently, at some point, Seth told his staff, "Guys, enough." I'll close with a story you may know and which I heard from Seth himself. Years ago, he spent a weekend in Boston but had to catch a plane back to L.A. His travel agent gave him the wrong time, and he arrived just as his plane took off without him. Seth got on the phone and was yelling at his travel agent when he looked up at an airport TV. The plane he was supposed to be on had just crashed into the World Trade Center. What's the point of this story? The point is, I like Family Guy, but God friggin' loves Family Guy. Chapter 9, Meet the Fans. One of the great perks of working at The Simpsons is that I get to travel the world talking about it. I have a lecture that's filled with secrets, scandals, and flat-out lies, just like this book. The lecture is called The Simpsons Backstage Tour. That's another one of those jokes no one gets. There is no backstage at an animated show. My first lecture was in 2000. Since then, I brought it to 400 venues in 36 U.S. states and 21 foreign countries. Advertisement. You can book me through Gotham Artists. Since we don't have a studio audience, these personal appearances are the only chance I get to interact with our fans. They are so sweet and appreciative of all the hard work we do. It's a wonderful change of pace from the handful of angry trolls who attack us on Simpsons websites. In fact, several times the gushiest fans I've met admit to me, "I'm one of those assholes on nohomers.net." I love these guys. I've learned a lot from them over the years, including many surprises. For example, when I ask them about their favorite characters, I often don't hear them say Bart or Homer. I hear Duffman and Disco Stew instead. Duffman started off as a one-shot character, and Disco Stew was a typo on a denim jacket. It was supposed to read Disco Stud. but because of this feedback, we've featured them both on the show many times since. Importantly, the fans helped resurrect Ralph. I'll admit it, around season 4, we were getting tired of the little weirdo. His inspired lines like, "My cat's breath smells like cat food," were getting harder to write and formulaic. So we simply stopped writing for him, and he only appeared once or twice a year. But when I visited college campuses, I observed how he was the most imitated and most quoted of all our characters. When I told the other writers about this, they brought Ralph back from exile. A decade later, he would open the Simpsons movie. He's the first character you see appearing in the Fox logo. Another big thing I've learned from my lectures is that Simpsons fans are cool. There's not a comic book guy in the bunch. The best part of my presentation is the Q&A. The most asked Qs make up the burning questions sections of this book. And the questions are always smart and never geeky. Except for this one. In season 4, Mo said he had small ears. In season 8, he said he had big ears. How can this be? The crowds are surprisingly well-behaved, too. Frat boys in the South are always polite. It's financial service executives who are out of control. I don't know why, but I'm always asked to speak at their conventions. These guys are generally drunk, and they tend to heckle. And they're not even good at it. One guy kept yelling, "Animal House!" throughout my lecture. These are the people who are handling your pension fund. Another thing I learned is that what you say on campus does not stay on campus. I once gave a speech at North Dakota State University in Fargo. Jealous? That night I got an angry call from the president of Fox saying, "You can't go around North Dakota bad-mouthing the network." I said, "I don't think I bad-mouthed it." And she said, "You compared the Fox network to a sewer." And I replied, "Not in a bad way." The biggest crowd I ever played to was 2,000 people at Florida State University. They told me they'd hired 5 bodyguards to protect me, 3 uniformed, 2 undercover. I told them I never needed a bodyguard in my life. They admitted, "Well, we had Gorbachev speak here last week, and we still had the bodyguards on payroll." That night, a nut rushed onto stage during my talk to pitch me some episode ideas. I yelled for my bodyguards, but no one came. They were all off smoking in the alley. I have a special speech that focuses on Judaism in the series, called "The Simpsons and Other Jewish Families." It focuses on Krusty, Rabbi Krasovsky, and the Simpsons family trip to Israel. I've given it at dozens of synagogues, Jewish film festivals, and charity events all over the world. The toughest act I ever had to follow was at a Jewish fundraiser in Toronto. They opened by showing a film featuring newsreel footage of the Holocaust and terrorism in Israel. The film ended with a picture of Anne Frank and the quote, "Hope is a dying ember in our world." The movie ended, the lights came up, and everyone in the audience was racked with sobs. And then the rabbi said, "And now the comedy of Mike Reiss." The best audience I ever had was at another Jewish event, the New Hampshire Jewish Film Festival. My audience consisted of every Jewish senior citizen in Manchester, New Hampshire. These people had clearly never seen The Simpsons, since they were circulating a cheat sheet one of their grandsons had made about the show. It featured such facts as, "Homer Simpson works in a barber shop." "This is wrong," I told one elderly Shebrew. "My grandson is never wrong," she replied. I expected a disaster, yet this was the sharpest group I ever had. They laughed at every joke, often before I finished it. There must be something in the water in New Hampshire. There are only 10,000 Jews in the state, but 3 of them are Seth Meyers, Adam Sandler, and Sarah Silverman. Believe me, not all my lectures go that well. I gave the commencement address at a girls' school in South Carolina. There were 700 people in the audience. I could hear 500 people laughing. What I couldn't hear was the other 200 people silently hating my guts. When the speech ended, I thought I'd done well until a phalanx of student security guards surrounded me. "We have to get you out of here," one guard whispered. "There are people in this audience who want to kill you." What had I done to make them so mad? I'd made a joke about then-President George W. Bush. I called him Satan with a learning disorder. Mind you, this was 2008. The U.S. economy had just collapsed, and Bush's approval rating stood around 9%. I guess all 9% were sitting in my audience. Was the Bush joke offensive? It certainly offended them, but the rest of the audience loved it. And it's my belief that a joke is only in bad taste if it doesn't get a laugh. Take Anne Frank. As I learned at my Toronto speech, there's nothing funny about her tragic story. Except that there's a classic joke that's so funny it overcomes our sensitivities. Here's the joke. Brooke Shields was so bad in a production of The Diary of Anne Frank that when the Nazis came on stage, the audience yelled, "She's in the attic!" I had this epiphany about bad taste in 2017 when blogger Milo Yiannopoulos was mired in controversy for his sexist, racist, homophobic blogging. It was only when I saw this smirking boob on Real Time with Bill Maher that I realized, oh my God, he thinks he's funny. Joan Rivers made the same kind of jokes as Milo. She called Michelle Obama Blackie O. But Joan's jokes were funny, and Milo's weren't. I had another realization after my South Carolina speech. A sense of humor isn't the ability to laugh at other people, it's the ability to laugh at yourself. I tried to explain this to a disgruntled audience member at another lecture, where I told the true story about a children's book I wrote being banned in Texas. The woman accosted me after the show and said, "I'm from Texas, and I didn't appreciate your making fun of it." I said, "I also made jokes about Jews, homosexuals, Arkansas, pedophilia, Woody Allen, the French, and myself. Did you have any problem with those?" "No, those were fine." So any joke is fine as long as it's not about you. "Mr. Rice," she said indignantly, mispronouncing my name, "you don't burn brighter by blowing out someone else's candle." "Well, you kinda do," I said. David Copperfield on my speeches. I'm a very apt pupil and audience for all things Mike Reese. I'm the one who gets sent all the videos of him on vacation and traveling around. They're really, really funny. Some of them you can't air, but I love them. They make me laugh. He sends me his latest speeches, too. People don't think of me as a joke teller, but there's tons of comedy in my show. So Mike tells me about troubles he might have with his latest audience because I suppose he thinks he can commiserate with a fellow person who's up there telling jokes. Worst speech ever. That South Carolina audience wanted to murder me, but I've had worse crowds. I gave a speech about The Simpsons just days after 9/11. No one felt much like laughing, particularly since the event was being held in the World Trade Center of Hong Kong. The man who'd booked me for the event was a big Simpsons fan. His audience wasn't. They were all native Chinese. They had never seen The Simpsons, and they barely understood English. I sweated through my one-hour speech and got exactly one laugh when I used the word Viagra. God bless that word. After the speech, my host said, "I've never seen a Chinese audience laugh that much." That single laugh was one laugh more than I got with the same speech at a college in the South. It doesn't matter which one. It was an Arkansas State University. My plane arrived in Mississippi. The closest airport wasn't even in the same state. My host introduced himself as Professor Eisenberg from New Jersey. I asked him, "What's a Jewish guy from Jersey doing teaching in Arkansas?" He sighed rabbinically. "Sometimes you take the hand life deals you." He went silent for the next 2 hours of the drive. When I arrived at campus, the lecture hall was filling up nicely. A young student said, "I can't believe so many people showed up on a Wednesday." "What happens on Wednesday?" I asked. "Church night," she snapped contemptuously. Then she asked if I needed anything. Just some water, I said. It's the one demand in my contract, a glass of water. She rolled her eyes like I was the queen of the divas and sulked off. She returned with a bottle of water and slammed it on my lectern. I went into my speech and didn't get one laugh, not even on Viagra. Uh-oh. My mouth went dry, so I opened my bottle of hard-won water. It was frozen solid. It was ice, and so was my audience. Even when my speech goes badly, I can usually redeem myself with Q&A. It's the liveliest part of my presentation. Any questions, I asked? None. These Arkansas students apparently knew everything about animation, TV production, and comedy. They shuffled out grimly, clearly thinking, I miss church night for this. After the speech, Professor Eisenberg took me to a restaurant with his two young sons. And then he vanished for a couple of hours, leaving me with his kids. Clearly, since I'd failed as a speaker, he decided to use me as a babysitter. Occasionally, when I tell this story, someone says, I'm from Arkansas. We don't act like that. I tell them this was Jonesboro, Arkansas. Oh, they reply, never mind. The Bermuda Triangle of Radio Stations. I was booked to give a speech in Bermuda, and the sponsor said they needed help selling tickets. Selling, I asked. People usually get to see my show for free. The sponsor told me the tickets were going for $55, and they weren't going fast. Folks, I give a pretty good lecture, but it wouldn't be worth 55 bucks if I threw in an oil change. To promote my appearance, they booked me on a local jazz radio station on Saturday at 9 a.m. No one in Bermuda is awake at 9 on a Saturday morning, I said, especially jazz fans. My sponsor assured me that it was a very popular radio show, and the DJ told me he was a big, big Simpsons fan. I got on the air with him. We're giving away 2 free tickets to Mike Reese's show, he said. So, Mike, give me a trivia question for our viewers to answer. Make it a hard one. All right, I said. What was the name of Bart's pet elephant? The answer is Stampy. Our phone lines are open, said the DJ. And they stayed open. Not one call came in for the next 20 minutes. Finally, the DJ said, maybe that question was a little too hard. Give him an easier one. All right, what is the name of Bart Simpson's dog? The answer, Santa's Little Helper. The phones remained silent for another 20 minutes. The laid-back DJ was getting upset. I'd never seen a stressed-out Rasta before. Mike, your questions are too hard. Give the audience a real easy one. Fine, I said. What is the name of Bart Simpson's father? It was another 10 minutes before the phone mercifully rang. The DJ listened to the caller, then turned to me and said, he says it's Santa's Little Helper. Is that the name of Bart's father? This was the same DJ who told me he was a big, big Simpsons fan. Unsurprisingly, I didn't get a big crowd that night in Bermuda, but I assured the few who came that they'd have some laughs. Then I told the tech crew to play the reel of Simpsons clips I'd brought along. Instead, on the big screen overhead, there appeared an ad for Frisky's Buffet. These people had paid 55 bucks apiece to see a cat food commercial. After the ad, the video screen went to an old episode of Seinfeld. The tech crew couldn't seem to turn it off, so the audience and I just watched the whole show. It was a good one, the yada 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 episode. See, I told the audience, I told you we'd have some laughs. Wrong professor theories. A professor at a prestigious university once wrote to me and said, I teach The Simpsons in my poli-sci class. Would you address my students? I've attached my notes to prepare you. I wrote back, I'd love to address your class, but I'll have to say that everything you're teaching them is wrong. He sent back a 2-word reply, don't come, which is the first time I'd ever heard that. From a man. This was not a unique case. They now teach entire courses on The Simpsons at many colleges, and I think this is an excellent sign of the apocalypse. I don't mind that they're teaching The Simpsons. What bothers me is that they're getting it all wrong. And if they're getting The Simpsons wrong, what are the odds they're getting physics right? For example, I was lecturing at a prestigious university, and a professor introduced me with a long discourse on why we named our hero Homer. Clearly, the character was on an epic journey through life, like the sagas written by the Greek poet Homer. It's a beautiful theory, except for the fact that it's 100% wrong. Matt Groening really did just name the character after his dad. Like almost everything we do, there wasn't much thought put into it. I met the professor of humor studies, that's a real thing, at another university. He expounded on his philosophy of what made The Simpsons funny. As he nattered on, I thought, if I were to sculpt a man out of pure shit, he would not be as full of shit as this professor. First of all, professors never back down. I attended a Slovakian animation festival where the grand prize winner was a student film called Pandas. The young director said in his acceptance speech, "My teacher gave me a C+ on this." I met his teacher and told her that Pandas was the greatest cartoon I'd ever seen in my life, epic in scale and filled with brilliant jokes. The teacher stood her ground saying, "I should have given it a C-. I've worked on The Simpsons for 30 years, and I've never thought too deeply about it, but scholars insist on analyzing our show. There's a website called Springfield Archive that collects academic papers about The Simpsons. I once spent a day scanning through them thinking, wrong, 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 wrong. Two basic mistakes pop up over and over. One is that if we parody something, we must hate it. Parody equals contempt. That's ridiculous. Al and I have parodied nearly every scene in Orson Welles' Citizen Kane because we love the film and know it inside out. We parodied Orson himself because he was a big fat whale. The biggest mistake is thinking that there's an overarching philosophy to the series. There isn't. The show is written by a diverse and ever-changing group of people, and each episode stands on its own. If the show has a philosophy, it's, we don't have a philosophy. Take the Halloween segment where Lisa wishes for world peace. Mankind destroys all its weapons, only to be conquered by an alien with a slingshot. "Foolish earthlings," intones Kang. "Your superior intellects are no match for our puny weapons." What's our point? Weapons are good? World peace is bad? We worked very hard to have no point. As Homer says at the end of the 1991 episode Blood Feud, maybe it's just a bunch of stuff that happened. Flat out nutty fan theories. Most academic theories of The Simpsons are wrong and boring. I much prefer the fan theories. They're wrong and crazy. Take the student who asked me at one lecture, "Does Ned Flanders have superpowers?" The internet says he does because in last week's episode he was looking through a wall. "That was a window," I explained. Another fan theory on the net states that after Homer went into a coma in one season 4 episode, he never woke up. The subsequent 26 seasons have all been a dream. This theory is not so much science as religion, a cool story with absolutely nothing to back it up. The most bizarre theory was inspired by our 1997 episode, The City of New York versus Homer Simpson, which takes place almost entirely at the World Trade Center. After the 9/11 attacks, this show was pulled from syndication for several years. The episode features a brochure for a $9 tour of New York and a picture of the World Trade Center. And the numeral 9 next to the Twin Towers sort of looks like 9/11. This gave rise to the incredible conspiracy theory that the Simpsons writers are all members of Skull and Bones, even though that's a Yale organization and we're largely Harvard grads without a single Yalie on staff. The theory continues that we were all recruited from Skull and Bones to join the CIA, and 4 years before the 9/11 attacks, we decided to leak our complicity in the conspiracy in an episode of our show. Let me put these conspiracy rumors to rest once and for all. They're completely true. Burning question. What do you say to people who say the show has gone downhill? I love this question because no one ever asks, why has the show gone downhill? It's always, what do you say to people who say the show has gone downhill? You're not fooling me. I'm still offended. It's like asking, I'm not saying your sister's a slut, but what do you say to the hundreds of guys who say she is? Here's the facts. TV shows age like people, and each episode is like a birthday. Many shows die in infancy. You can syndicate a show after 72 episodes, just like 72 years is the average life expectancy for an American man. When a show makes it to 100 episodes or a person makes it to 100 years, that's cause for celebration. Our show is a 658-year-old man. And you're asking why it's not as cute as it used to be? We're lucky the Simpsons can still pee. There's another way shows age like people. When they get old, they either get weird or boring. Those are your only two choices. By the end of its run, MASH got boring. Seinfeld got weird. Cosby got boring, but Cosby himself got weird. We've opted for weird. We do 2 to 3 plot lines per episode, which means after 3 decades, we've burned through nearly 2,000 stories. To do a new episode, we have to think of the 2,001st best idea out there. We've run through all the normal ones. Every Simpsons family member has had a crush on someone, or someone got a crush on them. We've killed off 7 recurring characters. In one background shot, we showed a graveyard filled with dead characters. At least we hope we're never boring. The pace of our show gets faster all the time. And since the show went high def in 2009, we jammed more jokes into the background that you couldn't have seen before. Recently, Lisa was in a library, and we had to come up with 30 funny titles for the books behind her. She's not going back to the library anytime soon. Al Jean on quality. It's hard for me to be objective about the show and what era is better. But I will say you can't say we didn't try hard, work hard, and last a long time. We always go up from our lead-ins, and whatever follows us goes down, which is a sign that people are watching you just for you. I don't know when it will end. There are factors of cost. All I can say is we really care about it like it's a show that's just starting out. We've never lost that feeling. Chapter 10, Seeing the World with the Simpsons. I visited 113 countries. Not by choice. My travel tastes range from Disneyland to Disney World. But my wife loves to travel. We've been to the North Pole and the South Pole. If they ever find an East Pole, I'm sure we'll be going there. My wife has dragged her clearly Semitic husband to every Jew-hating place on earth. Iran, Iraq, Syria, South Carolina. So why do I go? Because I fear my wife more than I fear ISIS. I'm always on the move. Portions of the book you're listening to were written in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Egypt, Japan, and Epcot Center. The sentence you're hearing now was typed in a Sudanese city called Wow. You may travel to forget about work, but I don't have that luxury because people watch The Simpsons everywhere. This hit me on our first day in Iran. My tour guide asked me what I did for a living. How could I explain our show to a young man who'd never left Tehran? Do they have cartoons in Iran? Do they even have TV? I began, I write for this show called The Simpsons. He said, you know, I really like the early seasons, but even a bad Simpsons is better than a good Family Guy. I thought about adopting him. The Simpsons is the only thing the Israelis and Egyptians agree on. In Iraq, fighting stopped from 5 to 6 every day so they could watch back-to-back episodes. If the show ran 24 hours a day, we could bring peace to that land. In Kurdistan, our guide Rebwar kept muttering in a pretty good Julie Kavner impression, "Oh, I love my homie." In Singapore, I gave a speech and was mobbed by fans. Young women tore at my clothes and hair like I was Justin Bieber. It was horrifying, and I can't wait to go back. I was in a restaurant in Malaysia, and the waiter told me, "Homer Simpson is a very Malaysian father." 5 minutes later, a Danish tourist said, "The Simpsons have a very Danish sense of humor." The Danish have a sense of humor? Australians, Canadians, Indians, and Brits are crazy for the show, but nobody loves it like South Americans. They see the show dubbed into Spanish by a Mexican cast, and many of them believe The Simpsons is a show about a Mexican family. Our Mexican cast members used to earn only $30 a week, except for Homer, who got $40 because he owns the microphone. I'm not being racist. These are the facts. Finally, our Mexican cast went on strike, not for more money, but for more dignity. And I thought, you're the Mexican Homer Simpson. How much dignity do you expect? Okay, maybe now I'm being racist. In 1990, when the show was being translated for foreign markets, we did something most shows wouldn't go to the trouble of doing. We sent our writer Jay Kogan around the world to supervise our voice casting. Jay did a remarkable job. The French voices for Marge and Homer fell in love and got married in 2001. If you ever wondered, would a woman like Marge ever marry a guy like Homer, you have only to meet this couple. They're just like their characters. The wife is tall and prim, the husband is squat and blunt. And like their characters, they seem crazy in love. L'amour! People in every country tell me their Simpsons voices are better than ours. Even the Czech Republic, where Marge is voiced by a man. And in Finland, I learned that children teach themselves to read just by watching The Simpsons. The show is in English there, with Finnish subtitles. If you're wondering how these countries manage to translate our puns and wordplay, the answer is, they don't. All our clever sign jokes are left in English with no translation. In Japan, when Bart called Moe's Tavern saying, "I'd like to speak to Mr. Kahalik, first named Al," it was translated as, "I'm looking for a very drunken man." By my estimate, about one-third of our jokes are lost in translation. It doesn't matter. The two-thirds that foreigners get, they really, really like. If you work in television, every time you see a TV, in a store, through somebody's window, you hope they're watching your show. In Bolivia, that really happened. As wizened old Mayan women were weaving baskets, they watched our show on tiny black and white TVs. In fact, there were actually riots in Bolivia when they cut Simpsons reruns back from 4 episodes a day to 3. Editor's note, did that really happen? Me, yes! During my trip there, my Bolivian tour guide brought me to his home, a one-room flat with a family of 5 stuffed into 2 beds. They didn't have a kitchen. They didn't have a bathroom. But they had every piece of Simpsons merchandise I'd ever seen. Simpsons posters lined the walls. Simpsons glasses filled the cupboards. Matt Groening is rich because this guy is so broke. But our tour guide in Colombia may be the biggest Simpsons fan on earth. When he found out who I was, he bombarded me with Simpsons trivia questions for the next 3 days. Apparently, one joke that just didn't translate into Spanish was Homer's line about possums. The line was, "I call the big one Bitey." Japan is the one big market the Simpsons can't crack. Apparently, the Japanese don't like the fact that the cartoon characters have 4 fingers. Disney actually goes to the expense of animating a 5th finger onto Mickey Mouse. What bothers the Japanese about 4 fingers? You won't believe the reason. Yakuza members swear loyalty by amputating their pinkies, so having 4 fingers implies you're in the Japanese mafia. Basically, the Japanese can't tell the Simpsons from the Sopranos. I spent weeks in Japan without seeing the show anywhere. I started to miss it. Finally, I told my tour guide I wrote for The Simpsons. His eyes lit up. "Really? That show is still on?" Yes, it is. 30 years, I crowed. Wow, I can't believe I meet a man who writes the Flintstones. No, not the Flintstones, the Simpsons. He looked puzzled. You call it the Simpsons?